Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a special seasonal episode of A Stab in the Dark, the UK TV podcast that investigates the worlds of crime fiction and TV crime drama that hangs up its stocking on Christmas Eve, only to find on Christmas morning that there's a severed leg in it. My name's Mark Billingham, and have I got a sack that's positively bulging with festive treats? Grow up. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by four, yes, four of the UK's best-selling crime writers. There's Chris Brookmyre, whose novel Black Widow won a veritable sleighload of awards and whose most recent thriller is set in space. There's Susie Holliday, whose book's Deaths of December couldn't be any more Christmassy if it was wrapped in bacon and roasted in an oven for 3 hours. And we have the brilliant Martin Waits, who writes under the names Tanya Carver and Martin Waits. We'll be sipping mulled wine and eating our body weight in mince pies, but instead of watching repeats of The Great Escape, we'll be reviewing The Year That Was, the best crime fiction, the best crime drama, the things we'd rather forget, and the books and shows we're looking forward to in 2018. Welcome to A Stab in the Dark. So let's start with Susie. Susie, or SJ Holliday, The Deaths of December. Now, you're obviously releasing this, you know, we're talking just before Christmas, although if you're listening to this in July 2021, it's going to sound a bit strange. But Susie, why a murder mystery set at Christmas?
Basically, my editor really doesn't like Christmas, and neither do I. So she said, can you write a Christmas murder mystery with loads and loads of murders? And I was like, yeah, that's a great idea, because there's loads of Christmas books that have got glitter on the front and all kind of nice, happy things and mistletoe and stuff. So we thought, why don't we just kill loads of people instead? And it seems to be going down well. So obviously there's a lot of people who are happy to kill off everyone at Christmas.
Why don't you like Christmas?
I don't know. It's just really stressful, and it's a big build-up to nothing, isn't it? There's not even a Santa. It's rubbish.
Oh, you've spoiled it now.
Well, that's a downer to kick things off. Presumably, do you do a thing where, because you are a holiday, so you are the holidays, do you not do a Christmas card where you all grin on it and just go, happy holidays?
No, we don't do that. We're probably missing a trick. Maybe that's something for next year.
So, no, either of you two ever thought about a Christmassy crime novel? A nice festive crime novel?
No, it's never occurred to me, and yet, you know, one of my favourite script writers or screenplay writers is Shane Black, and he almost always sets his stuff at Christmas. Even Iron Man 3 he set at Christmas. Seriously, you know, and it's that he must have that thing about, given that almost everything he makes is shot in LA, and so you get that kind of disconnect between the weather and the content. But no, it's never occurred to me to say anything at Christmas. And often maybe it's because of the time you start writing something, you're conscious of the time of the year or you've got a notion of why it's to be at that time. And I think Christmas, for all it... Did you get that thing where if you're watching a series, you don't want to watch the Christmas episode if you found yourself watching it in April? You know, you don't want to read a novel that's all about Christmas any other time of the year.
So you don't like Christmas, Susie. What's the best Christmas present you've ever received?
Not being in the UK for Christmas.
Oh, you like to get out. Just get the hell out.
Yeah, I had a really good Christmas a few years back where me and my husband went to Madeira on our own and just had a really, really quiet Christmas and didn't have any presents or anything. It was great. And I'm so proper Grinch, I know. It's not that bad. I mean, I've got nieces and nephews who love Christmas, so I go and see them and it's all happy and I wear my Christmas dress and I pretend that I love Christmas.
What, your Christmas dress?
I've got a Christmas dress which has got like Santas and sleighs and Rudolphs and stuff, and it's a shame we're not on film or I would have worn it.
So everybody looks at you in that dress and thinks, oh, there's someone who really loves Christmas.
Yeah.
And actually inside you're just
Yeah,
raging.
Yeah, I did an event recently where I wore the red Christmas dress covered in Santas and a little green sparkly sequin thing. I basically looked like a Quality Street, and everyone was like, "Oh, it's great! You love Christmas, don't you?" And I'm like, "No, I really don't love Christmas."
Martin, do you like a bit of Christmas?
I do. I've got a Christmas jumper as well, but it's a Christmas Doctor Who jumper, so it's got festive Daleks and weeping angels and TARDISes. Yeah. On it, and snowflakes, and it's lovely. I only wear it once a year, and even then not for very long, possibly about 15 or 20 minutes before, you know, I realise how ridiculous I look. But I mean, I do agree with what you're saying, Susie, about Christmas, because I mean, it's a massive, massive build-up. I always think that the build-up is more fun than the actual thing itself. Because, I mean, by lunchtime on Christmas Day, it's all over.
Yeah, you just want to go to sleep then and wait till the next year.
Well, no, I mean, as long as I watch the Doctor Who Christmas special and the Strictly Christmas special.
5 minutes and he's already talking about Doctor Who. I did warn you about this.
I know, that's it, I'm done now.
I've got a special Morrissey Christmas jumper, which when I bought it a few years ago, I thought, this is kind of cool and ironic, it's Morrissey. But now, of course, Morrissey's so tarnished, yeah. It's like I'm just a UKIP supporter out celebrating the holidays. Let's come back to you, Chris. You've had a heck of a busy year. The latest Jack Parlobay novel, Want You Gone, came out, closely followed by Places in the Darkness. Tell us a bit about that, your crime novel set in space.
I was just talking there about Shane Black. I suppose I kind of took my cue from that. One of the things I love about Shane Black is he's kind of the king of the mismatched investigator story. I was going to say buddy cop story, but you know, the Places in the Darkness was my attempt at that. But they're not buddies by any stretch, because it's two women who pretty much detest each other. And also, I suppose Shane Black always makes these about guys. It's very masculine banter type stuff, and I wanted to write something that was about two very mismatched women, and I just had the notion of setting it in space. It's not like I thought, oh, I've got a great idea for a buddy cop story, but I'll set it in space. You know, I was talking to my editor at Orbit, who wanted a science fiction novel, but wanted it to be a crime novel, and this idea came to mind, and it was a blast, because I don't normally write about police procedure, because other people know the rules, they do it better than I would, and also you get the nitpicking letters saying that you got everything wrong, so nobody can tell me the procedure isn't any way wrong, because it's all made up by me.
Yeah, but you still managed to upset one of my favourite you know where I'm coming, you know where I'm going with this. One of my favourite things on Twitter was the person that wrote you kind of going, this is a science fiction novel,
was,
for heaven's sake.
It was a one-star Amazon review that said, this is science fiction nonsense, all in caps. That was the kind of headline, and it said that Amazon should put a serious science fiction warning on this. I don't know what they mean by serious science fiction, but serious science fiction warning. I thought I bought this in good faith, and it was a waste of a tenner. And yeah, I put the cover and this comment on Twitter saying, if only my publishers had stuck a space station on the front or something. Of course, the front cover is dominated by a giant space station. And the blurb on the back is all about, you know, the first murder in space, etc. But this guy was obviously not paying attention.
No, what, thinking it was going to be like Murder in the Vicarage or something?
And who knows? Maybe he just saw this thing and thought it looked like a space station, looked like dumbbells from a gym, thought that was the murder weapon. You know?
And Martin Waits, this has been a busy writing year for you, I know. Yeah. So has 2017 seen a goodbye to Tanya Carver and a welcome back to Martin Waits?
Yeah, it has. I mean, I've been kind of quiet this year, in a way, by not doing any kind of, or many personal appearances, which a nation has duly mourned. But no, I mean, I haven't had a novel out this year, but I have been beavering away behind the scenes and writing ones, two, three. I'm writing, doing two at the moment. I mean, I'd given up. The Tanya's kind of came to an end. The final one came out in 2016, The Lost Girl. And it just seemed to have reached the natural end of the series as well. And then I got asked if I'd like to be Martin Waits again and write as Martin. And obviously I would, because it had become tedious in the extreme of trying to explain to people that I was Tanya Carver. No, I don't dress up. No, that really is me. No, you're not going to see me in a frock. And I just kind of got a bit fed up with that, and doing events as Tanya and getting told that, you know, we'd expected more of a looker.
Exactly. That was one of my favourite moments at the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival several years ago when you were nominated for the Theakston's Award. And Nobody knew. Nobody knew. No, it's nobody still knew a secret that you were Tanya Carver, and so Mark Lawson said, and our next nominee is Tanya Carver, and up stomps this big, airy Geordie. Definitely was somebody who I went, blimey, she's not much of a looker, is she? But now she's gone. She's gone. She's history.
Well, it's kind of never say never, you know, and I mean, that I've left it open if I want to put on the frock again, metaphorically. But no, I mean, I'm happy. I've done a new series. It's set in Cornwall. It's kind of a rural gothic noir folk horror. Okay. It's kind of a cross between Out of the Past, you know, the Robert Mitchum noir, and The Wicker Man in Cornwall. And, you know, and I thought, I went down, I mean, I've been, you know, spending about 2 years researching the locations for it in Cornwall. And I found what I thought was this brilliant, brilliant place. And I thought, oh, God, this has been untouched. Nobody's been here. Nobody's done anything. And so, I mean, what we do, my wife and I were just driving around looking for places. Then we'd stop in a B&B. And anywhere that we fancied, and you know, just kind of explore that bit. And you know, we were the next morning after staying in this B&B, we were ready to leave. And I thought, oh, she said, the woman who had the B&B said, well, what are you going to do today? And I said, well, we're just going to explore the area, thinking this is kind of unspoiled and we're the first ones to be here. She said, they filmed Poldark behind the back of the house. Do you want to go and have a look at that? And I thought, oh. So we had to start again.
But the book is coming. The book is called The Old Religion, and it's coming in June.
Yep, it is.
And I was with you, in fact, very recently when proofs were put into your hand for the first time. Is that still exciting? However many years you've been doing this, is that still an exciting moment?
I mean, I think it's exciting also because this is the first time in years that it's me again.
It's had your name on the front.
And I mean, the proofs, you know, obviously the proofs don't have the name of the book on it. You know, it's just a blurb to try and get people interested in reading it. So that the first thing that the book says is The Dark Heart of Cornwall, which one of the other writers we were with thought was the actual title. And when we had to disabuse him of that one and tell him no, he's like, oh, it's a good title. It's not really. But no, I mean, it is exciting to see your proofs. I mean, you know, I was reading it again in bed this morning and thinking, oh, it's good that. Oh, I love it. Oh, well,
that's
see,
a good moment.
The next
isn't it?
Bit coming up, that's a really good bit.
As opposed to that moment when you read something again that you haven't looked at for a while and go, ooh.
I know.
Why did I?
Naked baby photographs moment. Yeah. You're like, ooh. That's kind of wish this one could go in the loft.
So let's talk a bit about the year in general. We've all been around doing loads of literary festivals, and what kind of trends has anybody noticed? Anybody noticed anything kind of bubbling up this year? And I mean, the psychological thriller is clearly still massive. Do you see any sign of that stopping?
I don't know. Everyone keeps saying it's going to stop, but there seems to be no sign of it stopping at all. I've just been sent another couple of proofs, which are psychological thrillers that are out next year. And people still want it, but their readers are getting really picky, and they want it to be like always original. And how many more lines of inquiry of husband and wife can you go with?
Yeah, who can you trust?
Yeah, I mean, I think what might be the next possible thing is slight crossover of that. So settings like space, for example.
Cornwall.
That kind of thing, maybe kind of, I don't know, ghosts, hopefully, she says, writing a book about ghosts. Maybe just a little bit more of a twist on the same sort of thing. But I think the darkness of stuff isn't going to go away. I heard a horrible rumour one day that someone said that the next big thing is uplit. I happy books.
Oh yeah, I heard.
No crimes. Oh, everyone's happy and yeah.
Oh yeah, now Ian Rankin was talking about this.
I'm
in
not
the
sure.
Press, wasn't he? I mean,
I'm not sure.
He may have been misquoted, or it may have just been some chance remark. But something about how when the world is as terrible as it is, people want books that are sort of cozier and more reassuring, and everything's all right in the end. Rather as they did after the war, you know, sort of between the wars when you know, the golden age of crime fiction. Do you think there's anything in that?
No, because the actual golden age of film noir was immediately after the Second World War.
But also after the First World War. I mean, was kind of the first golden age of the horror movie as well, you know, the gothic universal horror movie, where you were getting a lot of soldiers coming home from the First World War, you know, who were horribly disfigured and, you know, or bits missing. And, you know, this has become a kind of realisation of just how horrible the war was. And the responses to that seem to come through horror movies. You know, so, and again, like you say, in the Second World War was very much film noir, you know, which was kind of a very... And also it kind of coincided with the rise of writers like Jim Thompson and David Goodis, you know, who were mining a really dark and cynical seam of literature. So I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, I think it tends to... I mean, obviously everything goes in cycles, but I don't think that there's going to be a great swing towards happy endings.
Oh, I hope not. Uplift sounds terrible. Yeah.
I mean, I used to work for Screen International, and we would always have these prognosticators in Hollywood claiming what was going to be the next trend. And I recall after Ghost and Pretty Woman were unexpectedly huge, especially given their budgets, and that was everyone then went out and tried to make mid-budget emotional rom-coms or something along those lines. And that was the prediction, but this was the end of the big blockbuster. Come that summer, these same prognosticators were saying a film called Dying Young with Julia Roberts was going to be the biggest movie of the year. And of course, it didn't even make the top 10. And all the biggest movies that year was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. It was, you know, Lethal Weapon 3 or whatever. It was just all big action movies. So I would treat the uplit predictions with a barrel load of
I don't think you can change. Crime readers enjoy reading crimes and psychological thrillers. They're not going to suddenly say, oh, no, I've had enough of that. Let's have happy ends and let's all go to the beach. And people still want the crimes because they like reading crime fiction.
Well, a lot of crime fiction has an inbuilt happy ending in that you're satisfied by the resolution.
Yeah.
And often there's an optimistic end to it. So, unless you're going to actually eradicate all the bad stuff, which is normal. Yeah.
But also, I mean, it's you know, it goes back to its basics. I mean, drama is conflict. You know, I mean, if everything's happy, who wants to read about happy?
I wish the people listening could see Martin's face at this point. He looks utterly nauseated at the very concept of happy.
The other trend, just to come back to the notion of the supernatural, was just thinking that the sort of blending of supernatural or the possibility of what may or may not be supernatural. I mean, one of the most interesting books I read this year was House of Spines by Michael Malone, which plays on whether something is supernatural or not and can kind of, without giving away which way it falls, which I thought was clever because it functions perfectly well as a crime novel, but adds a certain spooky element to it.
And there's there was the Sarah Pimber novel, Behind Her Eyes, which, without giving anything away, didn't have a conventional ending in genre terms at all. So yeah, maybe it's about it's going to be a bit of a mashup.
Slice, I believe, is the slice.
Oh, slice. You can't say mashup anymore.
No. According to my agent, the correct term is slice fiction, which means mashup.
Well, obviously, trying to predict any kind of trends is a very dangerous thing. But let's start talking about specifics. New authors, any new authors? We'll be talking about our favourite books of the year in a bit. But what about new authors, debut authors that have really knocked us on our backsides this year?
Ali Land.
Yeah. Good Me, Bad Me
was probably one of the first books I read this year, and absolutely loved it. Really dark. You know straight from the beginning that the main character's mum is a serial killer, so I'm instantly drawn into that kind of thing, and it's just so well done. I mean, it's pretty grim, but it's brilliant, really well done.
Chris,
I've read any debuts this year. I've read a debut that we publish next year.
That's fine.
Which is Dervla McTernan in her book The Ruin, which is about a police officer in Galway, which was absolutely brilliant. Really. Perfectly atmospheric and blending two storylines from 20 years ago. The first case a guy ever got sent out to when he thought he'd just joined and he thought he was being wound up by his mates, and it's that kind of comes back to haunt modern day events. And it was really maybe it's one of the things when you read well executed crime fiction that's set somewhere that you haven't read about before, so you're getting a different flavour to the... Some elements of it are different, and then some elements are very familiar in terms of the politics within the police, but it was really well done.
What about you, Martin?
Well, I haven't really read an awful lot of debut fiction this year. The one that really did stand out was Steph Broadribs, which I'm going to say the name of the second novel as well now.
Deep Down Dead.
And Deep Blue Trouble.
And Deep Blue Trouble. Yes, those are the two. Sorry, Steph.
But she got more of a shout out then, though, didn't she?
Yeah, we said her title 14 times.
Yeah, every permutation. But I loved that. I mean, I loved that book. It seems such a long time ago now, because I think that came out in January. But I mean, it was great. You know, it was a proper, good thriller. With a really exciting female protagonist, set in America. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Nothing not to love about
well,
it.
Well, it's strange and slightly scary when some of your books of the year are actually also debuts. I mean, the book that seems to have cleaned up in most ways this year is The Dry by Jane Harper, which is, you know, deservedly, I think it's an astonishing book. And the other writer for me that I sort of discovered this year was Susie Steiner, whose first book, Missing Presumed, was just gobsmackingly brilliant. And there was a real moment of revelation for me where I've been thinking for years that somebody needs to come along and kick the police procedural up its arse a bit, you know. And I read this book and thought, she's done it. But how did she do it? And then I thought, she hasn't actually reinvented the wheel. She's just given you characters you really care about. It's just that there is no massive secret, is there? There's no magic bullet. You just write brilliantly realised characters. So let's widen it out to books of the year. Okay, come on. A couple of books each. That would be on your books. I know we're going to say that at least one of the same books. Yeah. What about you, Susie?
Okay, to Here and Gone, Halen Beck. Fantastic book because it was like a proper American road trip thriller, but also just had great characterisation and I just kind of edge of your seat stuff. Absolutely loved it.
And if anybody listening doesn't know, Halen Beck is the pseudonym of the Irish crime writer Stuart Neville. And once you've read the brilliant Halen Beck book, you need to go back and read the brilliant Stuart Neville books.
And the other one, which I reckon none of you have read, is called Sweet Pea by C.J. Scouse. And it's being described as a cross between Bridget Jones and American Psycho. It's literally about this girl who just goes postal all the time, and it's just so funny, and it's terribly, awfully dark, but it's really, really good. She writes kill lists when she goes shopping, like, you know, the man in Lidl, tech, you know, it's like that kind of thing. And obviously at the heart of it there is a really damaged girl character, but the execution of it is just great. So if you want something a bit kind of non-realistic but really kind of dark and fun crime, I really like that.
And Mr. Brookmeyer,
yeah.
You?
Well, I'm in an uncomfortable position in that one of my two books of the year is written by the gentleman sitting opposite, which was Love Like Blood by Mark Billingham.
Well, let's scoot over
we
that.
We scoot over that one, right? So it doesn't get too uncomfortable.
Or spend the next 20 minutes talking about
talking
it.
About
I'm
great
not,
it is.
I'm not
yeah,
quite
yeah.
sure how I should react to that.
No,
thank
because
you very much.
I just was so swept up by the fact that not only is it such a terrifying and disturbing thing to write about, actually some of the reasons that people haven't broached it before make it all the more terrifying and disturbing, and I thought it was so well executed. But we'll get out of the uncomfortable man embrace here that's going on and move on to inevitably The Long Drop by Denise Minor, which won the McIlvany Prize, it won the Gordon Byrne Prize, it was shortlisted for, I think, two different CWA Daggers, and I think that's always a sign of a great book that doesn't win the CWA Daggers. But it's a fantastic novel. It's set in 1950s Glasgow. It's a true story, remarkable. I mean, one of these figures that haunted Glasgow, or the memory of this figure haunted Glasgow for generations, of Peter Manuel, who would go around and murdered whole families as they slept, or broke into the houses, murdered them, raped the women, murdered them in front of each other. He was just this truly unprecedentedly horrific figure in Glasgow. But the most bizarre thing that Denise focused on is that when he'd murdered this family, that the guy who wasn't in the house at the time, he was away on a business trip, I think, and the true story that he went out on a wild night on the town with Peter Manuel a few months later, ostensibly to find out information, but Denise has other theories about why this was going on. And it's just this kind of bizarre night of a huge pub crawl around a Glasgow that fortunately doesn't exist anymore. It's this incredibly masculine world that has strange rules in the underworld, strange politeness in the underworld. And you read it and think, even the geography of Glasgow is completely different because it was before the motorway was built that cut the city in half. And it's so evocative. I mean, you can pretty much...
The atmosphere just drips off the
Pretty
bridge,
much feel like you need
amazing.
To wash your jacket afterwards, because it's like it used to be when you went to the pub and your clothes all smelt of smoke. You feel like that by the time you've finished the book.
Yeah.
It was really quite incredible. And for a book that dwells in such horrible things, it's also really funny at times. You know, she's just got
she breaks a lot of rules in terms of the narrative voice. You know, she has lines in there like Peter Manuel did this because he was a nutter. You know, it's it's constantly surprising. You never know where she's going with it or where it's going to take you. And it's absolutely gripping.
No, deservedly acclaimed book, I think. What about you, Martin?
Well, I mean, the big novel that stood out for me this year was The Force by Don Winslow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a massive fan of his anyway. I mean, his books on the cartel, one of them being called The Cartel, and the other one, Power of the Dog, is just everything that you need to know. It's just the last word on the drug wars in South America and their impact on American society. But he moves to New York with The Force and concentrates on a kind of bent cop who's, or, you know, but is he, isn't he, you know, is it sort of turning the blind eye for the greater good kind of thing? And just kind of dissects the notion of law and order in this city and what it actually takes to police the streets, you know, and to keep order. It's a brilliant piece of work. I mean, one of the things that Don Winslow does so well is he seems to do enough research for 10 writers, but then he wears that so lightly when he actually writes the book that you know, because, I mean, I hate to read the kind of books where people tell each other their jobs. And you get that in so many police procedurals where, you know, people will turn up at the scene of a murder and tell each other their job, their rank, why they're there,
yeah,
what their particular interest is that they do. You know, just around a really sort of this clumsy exposition. And Winslow gets around all of that, you know, but he puts it all in. You know who these people are. You know what they do. You know what they're like. And, you know, but he never explicitly says it like that. It just becomes a kind of cumulative thing. And it's something, and it's a massive book, a real, real kind of massive doorstop of a book. And you're never bored once, and you never want to put it down. And you're gripped all the way through, right to the very end. And it's just the most emotionally satisfying piece of fiction I think I've read all year. Great piece.
We've done crime fiction. We've now moved on to the turkey sandwiches and bubble and squeak. And it's now time to turn our attention to the world of crime drama. So do we all watch, do crime novelists watch a lot of crime drama? Do you think that's safe to say, or have we had enough of it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's you know, it's what you do for an evening's entertainment after a hard day writing about crime. I mean, I find, because it's also the same kind of argument that some people have put forward, that they can't read a book while they're writing a book, or they can't read a crime novel while they're writing a crime novel, which I kind of disagree with, because, I mean, it's also like, you know, you can't watch the news, you can't read a newspaper,
you can't
look out the window. You know,
I stand by that one, and it's to do with having a strong narrative voice in my head. I don't want someone else's strong, distinctive narrative voice in my head. But when you're watching TV, it's a completely different way of consuming it. And for the same reason, I can read no end of graphic novels, or I can read non-fiction, and it doesn't interfere with... And I think with TV, you're not hearing... Even if there's a first-person narrator, it's not quite the same. You know, you can compartmentalise it, I think. So I find it really relaxing to watch any amount of crime drama.
Well,
and it doesn't interfere with my reading.
There is a amount of crime drama as well.
Well, there is. I mean, there have been a lot of big shows this year, just on Netflix. Mindhunter, Dark, Stranger Things 2, The Sinner. What's everybody been watching? We were talking about Mindhunter.
We were, yeah. I mean, I loved Mindhunter. I mean, and I loved it because it wasn't what I expected it to be. Even the title, I mean, David Fincher is doing a thing about the FBI called Mindhunter. And I thought straight away it was going to be something like Millennium, or, you know, the kind of serial killer of the week thing. And it was going to be dark and twisted. And I should have known that it wasn't, because Joe Penhall was behind it as well, writing it. And his plays were brilliant, but they were all kind of people talking through things in institutional settings. And that's what really Mindhunter was, you know, just trying to put together the whole science of forensic profiling, to, you know, criminal profiling, to try and work out what makes a serial killer, and actually to call them serial killers.
There's that moment in there where they go, sequence killer.
Say it, somebody.
I've only seen the first two episodes, but that was one of the things that struck me, was actually the, not just about the psychology, but about the bureaucracy, about the glacial pace at which an institution is as self-congratulatory as the FBI was at that point. You know, that's one of the things they've got to get over. Once something's been successful, it must be really hard to get them to change their mindset about something.
Yeah.
And it conveys that very well from what I've seen so far.
And I love the fact that the guy who is the lead, which we were saying earlier, but obviously we weren't saying it on air, so it doesn't really matter.
Let's say it again.
I can't say it again now. The fact that they chose somebody who was almost, you know, playing comedy at first, you know, and it was just kind of the way that he was young and naive, and he had brilliant comic timing because he was kind of behaving like such a klutz and almost like tripping over things. You know, it was like Norman Wisdom joins the FBI.
Oh, I see that.
And, you know, but and then from there...
Sorry, but I just now got an image in my head of Hannibal Lecter standing behind that thing going, "Are the sheep still screaming, Mr. Grimsdale? Mr. Pitkin? Hey! Susie, what have you been watching?"
I've been watching all the psychological thrillers. There's been hundreds of them this year, like Dr. Foster, Liar, Appletree Yard,
yep.
Big Little Lies, all of these. And they're all great, but pretty much everything I've seen this year suffers from the same problem of the ludicrous ending.
Yeah.
And I think that seems to be the theme for the year for me. You're really gripped and you watch something for like 5 episodes and you get to the 6th one or whatever, and you're just like, oh, for God's sake.
Talk us through some of the ludicrous endings.
All of them. Okay, Dr. Foster, the last episode of that was just horrible and grim and just should have been canned. Big Little Lies had a good ending, actually, because I never guessed it. And lots of people said to me, "How did you not guess that?" But I didn't. So it's always nice when you don't actually guess what's going on. Line of Duty. So this year I'd previously only watched one season, which was season 3 or 2, one of them. So this year I decided to watch all of them and catch up. And they just got more and more bonkers as it goes through, but it's also really compelling. But there's so many bits. And I was actually really angry by the end of season 4 where they kind of said, I know it's massive spoilers here, so if you haven't watched it, sorry. But the whole Balaclava Man thing, just I was like, what? And they went, oh, it's not really one man, it's a whole syndicate. It's like, that's not fair. You know, if we wrote stuff like that, they'd just be like, that's not
fair.
Well,
this is what I think we should talk about this for a minute, because I do think television gets away with stuff in terms of narrative, in terms of plot holes and that kind of thing, that we'd be crucified for.
Well, yeah. The point is well made that it's often at the end of something that has gripped you, and it's because the conceit or the hook is sufficient for you to invest in the characters and kind of in the promise that you're going to have a revelation, an explanation that's worthy of everything that's gone before. And often it's something horribly cobbled together. It falls apart at the end. I mean, I haven't seen any of the second season of Top of the Lake, but it was only a few months ago I watched the first season, and again, it was very gripping. And in the last episode, you're like chucking stuff at the telly.
Same thing with this season, I've got to tell you. Loved it until the last episode.
As writers, you construct with either the ending in mind at the start, or certainly by the time you know your ending, you'll go back through and make sure that the ending is satisfying, that it isn't just there to answer a few questions, that it isn't a sort of cursory way of dealing with themes. And you're right, we would be held to a higher standard than that. I mean, no end of... I think also what you're getting to see is that the curse of this supposed modern golden age of telly is that things are spun out to greater duration than they ought to be. So things have to be, say, 10 episodes that could have been handled in 3 or 4.
Yeah,
And things become more like a soap opera, and there has to be something that keeps... I mean, it was probably the worst culprit in this was actually The Killing. That something that clearly, when it was originally conceived, was expected to run for about 6 weeks, and they realised, this is going down really well, we have to extend it. And it just becomes this soap that gets more and more ludicrous, and by the end of that, you're just not buying anything.
I think there's actually a lot to be said for that, because the things that tend to put me off the big Scandi dramas, some of the big American crime shows, are the fact that you have to invest, you know, an amazing amount of time to sit and watch 22 episodes or something or whatever. I mean, the American shows I've really loved, Mindhunter, The Deuce, have all been quite limited. Mindhunter, I think, was 10. The Deuce, I think, was 8 episodes. As opposed to sitting down and watching 22 episodes or something.
With no promise that that's going to resolve things because if it's a hit, we need to have season 2, you know. And
the advantage of all the British-based shows you're talking about is they are sort of 3 episodes or 6 episodes or whatever, and you don't feel like this is the rest of my life flashing before me.
No, but I think there's becoming a trend to that as well now, that they're leaving stuff open. So there's like the end of something where you think that should be the end, and then there's a bit left. So it's not. And then you hear the next day, oh, it's been commissioned for a season two. And you're like, really? So, I mean, it's just a bit cynical, I think, some of it now.
I don't think that it's necessarily a new thing or even a question of length, because the worst, or one of the worst offenders, I think, for the kind of brilliant premise, awful conclusion. In fact, it became its trademark, I think, was Waking the Dead. You know, the Trevor Eve thing when he became the highest paid actor on TV, I think. It's a shame that the writers weren't, because, you know, that it was just, you know, every week you'd have a brilliant premise. Mm. And you think, oh, God, you know, and that was the first episode. And you watch the second episode and it's like, is this anything to do with what I've just watched? Because nobody could plot. Nobody could plot. Nobody could carry through an idea to its conclusion. And nobody could make it work. None of the writers that they had, and there's probably going to be some of the writers listening to this. But, I mean, I don't know how much interference was by the studios, but it just massively, every second episode of that was a massive, massive letdown.
And maybe a lot of effort, too much effort, goes into coming up with the first episode of something. You know, so many ideas, and then after that, if they've got commissioned on the back of that, there isn't the same thought and detail going into the execution, so there isn't a gracefully constructed story arc.
I mean, one of the things that I think happens, and I, having been on the receiving end of a TV adaptation this year, this is exactly what happened. You look at the script and the script, and you work on the script, and the script seems to hang together, and it all makes sense, and you like it, and then off they go and they film it, and then the thing is put together, and then you go, but hang on, you've cut that scene with X in the pub. And they go, yeah, oh, we had to cut that because of X, Y, and Z. And you go, but if you cut that scene, nothing that happens afterwards makes any sense, because that key piece of information is missing. And the people in TV terms tend to go, oh, that's fine. People, that doesn't matter. Yeah. But as a viewer, you watch that going, hang on, what have I missed? And what you've missed is the scene that got cut because the actor didn't give a particularly good performance, or they were overrunning by 5 minutes or whatever it might be. Whereas we have all the time in the world, in a way, to put the books together. Mm. And if an editor gets back to us going, that there's something wrong with that scene, we just fix it, we should fix it. But what about the sort of returning big hitters this year in terms of UK crime drama, Sherlock, Broadchurch? What do people make of those?
I don't watch those.
You don't? Whoa. Why is that?
I watched the very first...
Because you hate Christmas?
Yeah. No, I watched the first Sherlock years ago and I was a bit meh. And I watched the. I know you. Everyone's mouths are hanging open here.
They're listening devices, even as we speak.
It's just not really my thing.
Why not? Why not, Susie? I want to get into this.
I don't really like the actor in it. I know. I'm going to get shot now. I really shouldn't be saying this.
There are going to be all. What are they? Aren't they? They're called something very derogatory, aren't they? Fans of Benedict Cumberbatch, so I better not say. You know, he has a strong female following.
Cumberbatches,
terrible thing. But they're gonna come after you.
I know, I'm gonna get hate mail. I'm gonna go back and my Twitter mentions are gonna be off the roof. Well, luckily it's not live, so it's fine. I can move away. Broadchurch, Broadchurch, I watched the first one, and it was great, but it was one of those ones that I also thought you should just leave it at the first one.
Yeah.
And I think that it's been ruined. I started to watch, was it the third one this year or the second? I can't even remember. I started to watch it and I just kind of thought, no, I don't want to watch it because I loved that for what it was in the first one, and I don't want to kind of ruin that. So
actually, that's something that I think had a hugely satisfying ending. Broadchurch,
this
series.
Season.
I thought this series was the best of the three.
Oh, now I have to go and watch it.
Yeah, I did. I absolutely loved it. I was gripped every week, and the fact that it was, you know, it became kind of event TV, appointment TV, that you watched it every Monday night. You know, and you set aside time for that. It was like kind of watching, you know, old school drama in an old school way. You know, you weren't streaming it, you weren't, you know, downloading it, you weren't watching the whole episode after episode like you do on Netflix. You know, you came back there every week to find out what would happen at the end. And I absolutely loved it. I really, really did. And I felt properly satisfied.
I thought it was one of those shows that, like Chris just said, there's two or three episodes in the middle of it, you just think, they're treading water here. This is a four-part series made into an eight-part series. You know, and it's just, oh, we'll just throw in another suspect to the mix during this episode. So, and you end up feeling slightly cheated because you just think, I'm watching this just to find out what happened. You know, I'm not getting anything out of it other than I just want to know what happened.
I didn't see any of the subsequent series. I remember really enjoying the drama of the first and the depiction of bereavement and all of those things. But I remember, just because of personal peccadilloes, getting really angry about the fact that they had this supposed psychic character
Oh, yeah.
who The first, for the first couple of episodes, I thought this is really interesting because this is what they do. They get close to an investigation so they can make out that they've divined information. But then by the end of it, they'd actually implied that he did have psychic powers. And at that point, to me, that's now a supernatural drama, you know, because... You know, there is no way of rooting that in reality because to this day there's still no evidence anyone can do that. And I thought, I don't buy that. Also, I never really bought the conclusion of the first Broadchurch. I thought that was an attempt to think of the person you least expect and nail it on them.
I want to bang the drum for the Deuce on Sky Atlantic. Is it the Deuce? Which I just think was a fantastic show. Again, nice and compact, 8 episodes. And it's a show largely written by crime writers, by American crime writers, conceived by David Simon, who we talked to on this show not so long ago, of The Wire, and George Pelicanos, and then written by the likes of George Pelicanos and Lisa Lutz and Megan Abbott and Richard Price. I mean, just incredible stuff. And I just, you know, if you haven't seen it, please watch it. Am I the only one that's seen it around this table?
Yeah,
I don't know, Sky.
Just Sky. I must say, I didn't really see a lot of UK crime drama this year, but the two American ones that I really loved was obviously, I think Bosch continues to deliver really tight story arcs, great characterisation. There's not a moment wasted. You know, you're not feeling like they're padding out a story to more episodes. In fact,
this is, again, for anybody listening, this is Bosch, based on the Michael Connelly novels, and people that love those books, and I'm one of them, were very, you know, very scared about this thing coming to TV, and it nearly happened for many. I think at one point there's a rumour Harrison Ford was going to play Bosch. This is how long ago you know, the things were optioned for the screen, and so there was a lot of trepidation when that show first came and looked at the casting and this guy Titus Welliver, and they've updated, and it is just brilliant, as you say.
And the other thing which seemed, I don't know if it was even this year, but one of the ones I enjoyed most this year when it was on, made by Amazon, was Goliath with Billy Bob Thornton, because again it was very well executed and it wasn't designed to be set up to come back for another. It was just a legal crime drama, but Billy Bob Thornton was just perfect in it.
What about shows that are coming up in the new year? Anything you're especially looking forward to, Martin?
Well, in terms of crime?
Yeah.
I'm not sure, really. I mean, obviously, I'm looking forward to the new series of Doctor Who.
Go about 20 minutes there without giving it a mention.
Made by Chris Chibnall, who made Broadchurch, starring Jodie Whittaker from Broadchurch.
The way it all comes together is
marvellous,
isn't it?
It's incredible, isn't it? See, this is the way my mind works.
And there was a second series of Mindhunter, presumably. I think there's going to be one of those.
I think there will be a second series. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I love, which I would love to see a second series of, was The Punisher. You know, the Netflix Marvel Comics series. Because, I mean, that was just straight down the line crime story.
Right.
No kind of super heroics. But again, you know, 13 episodes, could have been 10, could have been 8. A little bit padded out.
There were no superhero stuff. Nobody had any powers.
No?
No powers at all.
Not
at all. Promise.
Frank Castle got the power to kill you dead and make you stay there.
Yeah. Oh, okay. He's just it's hard.
Yeah. Hard, yeah.
He's just hard. That's his superpower. He's hard.
He's troubled.
Okay. What about you, Susie? Will you be watching the next series of Broadchurch? You won't be watching Sherlock if it comes back, presumably.
No, I don't know what's coming up next year, actually. I need someone to give me a TV guide.
You need a big bumper edition of Radio Times or something.
Is there going to be another Line of Duty?
Oh, yeah.
Apparently there is. It's going to be two more lines of duties. So. So, yeah, we'll watch them for ludicrous fun.
You'll get to the end and go, I don't... The other thing in the end of this series was there was the hairbrush.
Yes.
Again, that's not a spoiler for anybody, but if you watched it, you went, hairbrush!
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So watch it, just to know why Susie and I are both going, hairbrush!
And the hand.
And the hand.
That hand really annoyed me, actually, the whole way through. And no one ever checked what was wrong with her hand, and then suddenly she's got MRSA and it gets cut off. It's like, come on.
Is this true? Okay, we've all done a bit of forensic-y stuff in our time. Can you, I can't remember if this is in Line of Duty or in something else I saw, but if you chop somebody's hand off, can you use that dead hand to operate fingerprint touch on their phone?
Well, that's what she was doing.
I don't think you can.
I don't think you can either.
Because there's no blood moving through. Please write in to A Stab in the Dark and let us know. Don't actually put this into practice and test it.
The fingerprint would work, but I don't know if the fingerprint recognition would work.
That's
right, because it's not.
I had at the end of, it was, I think it was the end of A Snowball in Hell, somebody just pulled
pull somebody's eye out to use for a sort of optical recognition thing. And I actually asked a consultant ophthalmologist whether this would work, and he said yes. And then there was someone who was a kind of junior ophthalmologist come up at an event and said it wouldn't. And I thought,
if your books were held up to well, that exactly, level it was, of scrutiny, can you abseil down the side of a building on somebody's intestines? I'm not sure, Chris.
It was
dear Mr. Brookmeyer, my enjoyment of your otherwise excellent book. Okay, yeah. So look, what about books? Let's talk about some of the books that are coming out, because obviously we're lucky enough to get books in advance. We get advanced copies and proofs, so we see the stuff that's coming. What are people looking forward to? Goes without saying we're all looking forward to The Old Religion by Martin Waits.
But absolutely.
Is Martin Waits looking forward to next year?
I'm looking forward to the new Mick Herron.
Oh. Yes. Yeah. Let's just pick up Mick Herron for a minute or two.
Yeah, I'm actually halfway through it just now.
Oh, it's so brilliant. Yeah.
And I'm very, very jealous and not going to talk to anybody who's read it or half read it.
But that's London Rules, which is coming next year from Mick Herron, wonderful.
I adore him. And it's kind of annoying that somebody as talented and brilliant as that is so nice as well. Yeah. And he's such a nice guy, and you just can't, fault him for being so successful. You can hate him really for that, because he's just kind of got everything got, and he's such a good writer and such a nice bloke. Hate him. So, but I can't wait to read his new novel.
Right. Right. What about you, Chris?
I'm afraid that's my thunder stolen. That was. in fact, I don't know what's coming out next year, because you do get sent proofs, and I've read a few of them already. So, for instance, The Ruin was one of the ones that's coming out early next year, and the Mick Herron. The cast, this menagerie of characters that he's got, but of course Jackson Lamb at the heart of it all is just one of the most entertaining creations in British crime fiction, and I don't know how long. I mean, he just makes you laugh all the time, and yet is constantly surprising.
What about you, Susie? What advanced copies have you read that are salivating?
Two quite stand out. The Bone Keeper, Luca Veste,
absolutely.
Brilliant kind of horror, kind of crime stuff, which I really love, and it was really well done, and that's going to be huge, I hope. Another contender for Cornwall Noir, Amanda Jennings.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Her new one, The Cliff House, is out next year, and it's great. So you're just saying, you've got to up your game with the Cornwall Noir.
I did ask Amanda, I think because the novels are coming out at the same time, I did say, did she fancy doing some joint
good thinking.
Events?
Yeah.
Never heard back.
I'm really looking forward to yours. I love Cornwall. I love that kind of, it's a little bit weird, so it's a perfect setting for a crime novel. Amanda's is great because it's kind of partly set in the 80s, and you think it's
so
just...
So is Cornwall.
You think it's one thing, and then it actually has a very, very satisfying ending, so yeah.
I did remember something I'm looking forward to next year, which I just received the proof and haven't got around to it, which is Doug Johnson's new book, Fault Lines.
Oh, yes. Fault Lines, which I have read. I have read already.
That as well, that's great.
And talking about books that's coming next year, tell us about what you've got coming next year. not under your own name, but
Ordinarily I'd have a new crime novel, but seeing as my publisher's published two in the same year, I would normally have a gap, but now I've co-written a novel with my wife, and we've written it under the pseudonym of Ambrose Parry, and it's called The Way of All Flesh, and it's set in 1847 in Edinburgh, and it's mixes fiction with real historical characters set around the early pioneering days of anaesthesia, and in particular obstetric anaesthesia.
And it's going to be huge from everything we're hearing. I think this is going to be a big book.
Yeah, I've been quite taken aback. 22 years of writing, and my wife comes on board for one book, and suddenly everything gets taken up a level.
We should all... And the other book, you've all mentioned books that I was going to mention. The other one I think that is going to be a big book next year is 13 by Steve Kavanagh, which is an amazing book. Again, a kind of real... I mean, the books before that have all been great. This really feels like a step up into massive big leagues to me. I just thought it was an incredible book. So really shaping up to be a good year, I think, 2018, in the world of crime fiction and crime drama. But before we finish, let's just get back briefly to Christmas. Just for Susie. What do we all eat for Christmas dinner? Do we all have traditional Christmas dinner?
Well, I think I'm supposed to be having duck this year.
What?
Yeah, duck. Yeah, breaking with tradition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But with all the trimmings. Duck and all the trimmings.
Oh, yeah, and all the trimmings.
And do you still have, like, Christmas pudding and stuff? Or do you do something weird for that? Like
no,
lemon meringue
weird.
Pie?
Wait, duck isn't weird. It's
duck's
still a
quite
bird.
Weird for Christmas, isn't it?
Yeah.
Goose. Oh. Goose isn't weird, but duck's quite weird.
I had goose one year.
Might have KFC.
Well, that hardly counts as chicken, does it? No, but or Turkey. I mean, Turkey can be a bit bland, can't it?
No, I agree. I do agree. Chris?
It'll be at my mum's, the turkey with all the trimming. So it doesn't get bland because she makes, you know, about five different types of stuffing and insists you have some of it all, bread, sauce and all of the...
Why do we only ever say trimmings at Christmas? You know, it's not like the rest of the year we have roast chicken and you never go, can we have roast chicken and all the trimmings? Trimmings is something that just exclusively Christmas,
for
isn't it?
Pubs do that.
Do you?
With all the trimmings.
Just meaning veg.
I mean, what Niles once contemptuously described in Fraser as fixins.
What about you, Susie? We know you hate and detest Christmas, but
you would never in the world guess what I'm having for Christmas Day.
Oh, let's try.
An Indian.
Yes!
Just curry. What? Home delivery curry?
No. I'm going to my mum and dad's, and on Christmas Day, there'll only be me and my husband and mum and dad, and we're having a big walk on beach followed by a homemade curry. On Boxing Day, on Boxing Day, though, we are having more of an actual Christmas Day because my sister and my grandparents and nieces, and we will have actual Christmas food, but it will be roast beef.
Okay. The meal of the year for me at Christmas, without doubt, is what you have on Boxing Day, which is bubble and squeak, just huge amounts of bubble and squeak with cold turkey and pickles and chips.
Oh, yeah. But do you not like to do? Do you not like to do a ham for Boxing Day?
Do a ham.
I'm sorry, I'm from Newcastle.
Walked out of a Dickens novel. Shall we have a ham?
I do that
with all the trimming.
I do. I get it on Boxing Day, you know. And
he's even got his Bob Cratchit hat on.
Well, then we've dealt with food. What do we all want for Christmas? You know, blah blah, peace on earth, etc., etc. But what do we really want for Christmas? One present you would love to be given. In somebody's bulging sack. Grow up again, Chris Brookmeyer. Come on, what do you want for Christmas?
I already got my Christmas present early.
Which was
the publishing deal.
Oh, publishing deal for the new book. Yeah. Happy Christmas, Martin.
Well, putting aside all ideas of a publishing deal, it's a Doctor Who thing.
Oh.
They've just completed Sharda, the missing Tom Baker story from 1979.
Which was the basis for Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
It was, yeah. And look, Mark's backing away now. And that's just come out on Blu-ray now, so I'm massively excited about that.
Okay. That, ladies and gentlemen, is about it for this special festive episode of A Stab in the Dark. So in this episode, what have we learned? We've learned that Susie Holiday hates Christmas, that a space boo hiss, that a space station on the cover of a novel is not sufficient information for slightly dimmer readers, and that Martin Waits can't go for more than 5 minutes without mentioning Doctor Who. We will be back again in 2018 with more of the biggest names in crime fiction and crime drama. You should see who we've got lined up. But in the meantime, you can find out more about A Stab in the Dark at uktv.co.uk/astabinthedark, or get in touch with us on Twitter, #astabinthedark. Now, if this is the first time you've listened to us, what on earth is wrong with you? There are 20 episodes waiting for you to listen to on your podcast app, featuring chats with everyone from Mark Gatiss and The Wire's David Simon to Ian Rankin, Val McDermid, Patricia Cornwell, David Morrissey. We get the very biggest names. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe and review us on your podcast app. Yes, I know I always ask you to review and rate, but it really does make a huge difference to us if you can leave nice messages. If you leave nasty ones, well, Santa won't give you that My Little Pony you asked for this year, and he'll probably do something revolting to your cranberry sauce. Oh, and tell your friends about us too. And just a quick reminder, you can watch the best crime drama every day on UK TV channels Alibi and Drama. There's loads of Miss Marple, Death in Paradise, Sherlock, Father Brown, Murdoch Mysteries. It's all there. So with that, it's a huge thank you to my very special guests, Chris Brookmeyer, Susie Holiday and Martin Waits. And thanks to our producers, Paul Hirons and Joel Porter. My name's Mark Billingham. Have a very Merry Christmas and a happy and healthy New Year. And thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds.
Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.